You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
The American and British governments, together with multinational oil companies, have been pushing for a system of contracts in Iraq's oil industry that would give the multinationals access to Iraq's oil and indeed control over Iraq's oil for the first time in more than 30 years. What we've done in the report is to try and put the price tag on that to estimate how much that will cost Iraq. And the figures are quite staggering. What we found is that this policy which America and Britain are pushing would cost Iraq between $74 and $194 billion in terms of lost revenue compared to continuing with the existing system. To put that in perspective, that's potentially more than six times Iraq's current GDP. The new structure for the Iraqi oil industry was first designed in the U.S. State Department back in 2002, even before the invasion. It was first designed by something called the Future of Iraq Working Group, which the State Department put together. Following that, the policy was then developed through each of the subsequent stages of Iraqi interim and transitional government, under the close influence of Britain and America. The situation now is that senior officials and politicians in Iraq have accepted this policy that that Britain and America have proposed, and are preparing to sign long-term contracts with oil companies on all of the fields which aren't currently in production. Those new fields account for around two-thirds of Iraq's known reserves, plus any reserves which are yet to be found, which could be equally huge. The oil companies have been calling for a form of contract in oil production called production sharing agreements. They've especially worked through a lobbying organization called the International Tax and Investment Center. The ITIC was an organization set up following the collapse of the Soviet Union to ensure that the transition in the former Soviet states was as business-friendly as possible in terms of tax and investment regimes. The ITIC has offices in Moscow, Baku, Almaty, Kiev, as well as Washington, D.C. and London. Now, the ITIC in 2004 wrote in a strategy document that they saw Iraq as a beachhead, this was their word, for expanding these kind of business-friendly practices into the whole of the Middle East. They then produced a document which they've used to argue for PSAs. This document, firstly, it was repeated almost verbatim by the British Foreign Office in its discussions with the Iraqi oil ministry. Secondly, it was presented by the ITIC lobby group alongside the oil companies and along with the World Bank and the IMF to to some of the most important ministries in Iraq, the finance ministry, the oil ministry, the trade ministry. So what we see here is that public institutions, the American and British governments, as well as the World Bank and IMF, supposedly trying to help the reconstruction of Iraq, actually siding with the oil companies to rip Iraq off from its oil revenues.
Now, everybody in the Bush administration, many of those in Congress, are talking about this new democracy in Iraq, and it's all about the new Iraqi constitution. But this constitution works nicely, doesn't it, in the context of the oil companies and this huge ripoff?
There are a couple of problematic elements of the Constitution in relation to oil. Firstly, the Constitution states that all undeveloped oil fields, that's the two-thirds of Iraq's oil reserves that I was referring to, should be developed according to market principles and to encourage investment. The second element of the Constitution that relates to oil states that it wouldn't be the oil ministry in Baghdad which negotiates with oil companies. It would be regional administrations. Now, the big danger there is that that would hand negotiating authority to the regions which don't have the technical competence of the oil ministry in Baghdad, nor do they have the negotiating power, the bargaining position that the country as a whole has. Essentially, this means a weaker negotiating position and a much worse deal for Iraq. The U.S. administration's line that its aim in Iraq was to build a democracy. The type of contract that is being proposed by the U.S. government, along with the oil companies, as I mentioned, it's called a production-sharing agreement. What these things do is they fix the economic terms of oil development for periods of up to 40 years. They restrict the government's, firstly, its ability to control its oil development, and secondly, its ability even to regulate oil development, to pass legislation, whether labor laws or environmental laws and so on. And then on top of this, they hand arbitration powers to international trade tribunals and investment tribunals. Now, what all of this does is it deprives the Iraqi government of the ability to control its oil industry. It deprives it of its sovereignty. Now, far from creating democracy in Iraq, I would say this is taking it away and handing it to multinational companies and arbitration courts.
That was Greg Muttit from the British NGO Platform, one of the authors of a report titled Crude Designs, issued in November. He was speaking with Flashpoint's Dennis Bernstein about their findings that strip away any democracy pretext for the invasion of Iraq, and, as you can hear, also demolish a type of technocratic critique of the war put forward by many establishment critics, that the administration was inept and did not plan for the post-invasion scenario. It's pretty clear that they did plan, extensively, in accordance with their objectives, how to snag the oil. The oil companies have been unable to implement the plan thus far due to the ongoing fighting, a situation that they apparently did not anticipate. You can read the entire report, Crude Designs, on the web at crudedesigns.org. That the Iraqi people are largely without the necessities of life, I submit, is clearly not of concern to these government and corporate planners. And the material you will hear on the program this week will support this assertion that the administration doesn't give a damn if millions in Iraq starve to death, as long as there are enough people left to work and guard the oil fields and staff a puppet government with the legal power to sign oil contracts. Therefore, the people who are running the U.S. government and its military and are in the Congress are complicit in a project of international gangsterism, and they are making us, the people of the United States, complicit as well. Therefore, they have abrogated any right to leadership, to hold public office, to purport to make laws that they demand we follow. They have forfeited any obligation to obedience from those sworn to obey. They should be objects of scorn and revulsion from every decent person. This is the case I believe the material in this week's show will prove. The question ultimately for all of us is, what do we intend to do about it? This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Before we get into the material, an announcement for listeners on 88.1 in Ithaca. Ithaca Community Radio is having a general meeting to discuss the next steps in developing 88.1 as a community radio station. I hope that you can attend the meeting and get involved. The meeting will be this coming Tuesday, January 10th, at 7 p.m. at the Tompkins County Library in the Borg Warner Room. The library is located at the corner of Cayuga and Green Streets in downtown Ithaca. If you're unable to make a note of this info now, you can find it on the web at IthacaRadio.org.
This land's for you and me and fraud and thuggery. Screw you, foreign policy. Who needs evildoers with friends like these?
In the following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse, you will hear a lecture given by Dr. Christian Parenti at the 14th Sociological Forum at the Community College of Southern Nevada on November 2nd of 2005. Christian Parenti is the author of The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq, and a visiting fellow at City University of New York's Center for Place, Culture, and Politics. His talk focuses on work from his new book, and is followed by a panel discussion with members and former members of the military. Dr. Parenti and the panel are introduced by Professor Carlo DeFazio.
Tonight we have a very distinguished person speaking. He's written many articles for The Nation. He's been to Bolivia, Afghanistan, Iraq. He just came back from Iraq. He's written several books, The Soft Cage, Locked On America. He's written essays for another book called Prison Nation. And his most recent book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq, and that's the book that he'll be talking about on this visit. It's really an honor to introduce to you Dr. Christian Parenti.
Thank you very much, Carlo, and thank you very much, Michael Granata. It's really an honor to be on a panel with a group of veterans. So I think that the best way to approach the situation in Iraq is to ask two interrelated questions about this war that was supposed to be short and was supposed to already be over. One, why has it happened? And then also to look at how it's happened and to figure out the connections between the two. We're told that the war happened because there was an imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction. This was a defensive action by the United States against those who threatened the U.S. There was a link claimed to exist between al-Qaeda, which did September 11th, those attacks, and the regime of Saddam Hussein, and that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Well, it turned out that neither of those claims were true. So then the secondary reason, which had sort of always been in there, the liberation of the people of Iraq from this despot, Saddam Hussein, came to the fore. But unfortunately, the conditions on the ground don't look much like liberation. The status of women in Iraq has declined horribly and precipitously since the invasion. Women that I interviewed in Iraq complain about being forced out of jobs, about the tyranny of rape, the threat of constant lawlessness, the threat from religious fundamentalists that they should not drive, not work, not be educated, that they should cover themselves. So for half of the population of Iraq, this liberation has been in many objective ways not a liberation at all. If it wasn't for a defensive move against weapons of mass destruction or to liberate the people of Iraq, why did the U.S. go in? Well, there's two answers to that as well. At one level, there's a deep structural project that's been underway for a long time, the American Empire. This country was built on conquest. It's been fighting wars abroad for many, many years. Every regime, every administration in the U.S., I think, has been committed to expanding U.S. power abroad. Clinton, before Bush had his version of a war against Iraq, his father had a war against Iraq, and every president before them had their wars or their projects of pushing U.S. power internationally. So now, what were the structural reasons for why the U.S. would want to control Iraq? Well, basically because it has the second largest oil reserves in the world. And that offers two forms of power. One, the corporations that can control that oil make enormous sums of money. Iraqi oil, like Saudi oil, and like a lot of oil in the world, is actually state-owned. So if the regime in Iraq could be transformed and replaced with one that was amenable to privatization of oil, then possibly U.S. firms could stand to make enormous sums of money. The second thing about oil is the geostrategic importance of it. The U.S. actually doesn't use that much oil from the Middle East. About 14% of our oil comes from there. Most of the rest comes from Canada and Mexico and Venezuela. But the EU Europe, which is now, you know, has a market of 400 million people and in many ways could potentially be a very serious economic rival to the U.S., uses a lot of Middle Eastern oil. China and India and Japan, particularly China, which has been growing at like 9% a year for about 15 years, is heavily dependent on Middle Eastern oil. So if the U.S. could establish itself as the petroleum gendarme, the cops that guarantee the security of the oil upon which the other two poles of the world economy, Asia and Europe, depend, that would give the U.S. all sorts of power indirectly that it could parlay into other types of advantage beyond just the direct profit and control of oil. It could use that leverage in trade negotiations, in diplomatic matters, to corral votes in the UN, as it used its military role during the Cold War when protecting Europe and Japan against the threat of socialism in the Soviet Union. It could leverage its role as the security shield in other ways in the UN around trade negotiations to get its way in the realm of economics and diplomacy. Now, I'm not just guessing about that. I'm actually just telling you what the clique that controls the Bush administration told all of us in the documents that they produced over the last 10 years. When Clinton was president, the group of men who now are the inner core of this administration, many of them were associated with a think tank called the Project on a New American Century. It was sort of like a cabinet in waiting. They put out a number of policy papers and they wrote an open letter to Clinton criticizing his foreign policy and demanding a new direction. And in these various documents, they laid out precisely this project I just described of the threats posed to the U.S. Of them, they named a plethora. But the primary ones they saw were from allies, from the EU and from China, particularly China. They were obsessed with China, obsessed with the long-term rise of China. And they were worried about how the U.S. was going to maintain global hegemony for the long term. And they saw the end of the Cold War as this really unique opportunity to lock down power arrangements in a new way. And they were furious with Clinton for not doing that more vigorously. Clinton, of course, was trying to do that through his own methodology, which was this discourse about humanitarian interventionism, that the U.S. military intervention would be in the interest of human rights, etc., etc. And they thought this was inadequate and just needed to be stated up front that the U.S. was going to control the planet militarily. And so they laid this out in a number of documents, which then were published openly as the National Security Doctrine of the United States in the Bush administration in the beginning of its second year. And it was interesting how that came out. Harper's actually did an article which had a sort of investigative flavor to it, unpacking and tracing the origin of these ideas in the Project on the New American Century, and then talking about how some of this had been in a draft for the National Security Doctrine, and then there had been such outcry that they suppressed that draft. And just as that article came out, Bush preempted that article. Not, I mean, he wasn't trying to preempt that article, but in effect preempted it by openly admitting all this, saying, yes, this is our National Security Doctrine, and it is that we will not allow any peer competitor to get ahead of us, and we will maintain absolute military supremacy over the entire planet so that we can have our way in pushing open markets and privatization and in all other matters, so that we can guarantee the cooperation of other states in whatever crises might face the U.S. And they were very honest about that. So the people who devised that theory of the world included Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Cheney the Vice President, Rumsfeld Secretary of Defense, Wolfowitz now head of the World Bank. So if they were to pursue this, how would they do it? Well, to get control of Middle Eastern oil. Well, how would they do that? They needed an excuse to go in and really control and dominate Iraq and to, quite importantly, replace the bases that they had in Saudi Arabia, because there is a low-level civil war going on in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi royal family is under tremendous pressure to get the bases out of the Holy Land where Mecca and Medina are. And this is one of the primary grievances of Osama bin Laden, right? He wants American soldiers out of the Holy Land. So the Saudi royal family, which, just to digress, cooperated for many years with Osama bin Laden and the CIA when Osama bin Laden was helping the CIA and the Saudis and Pakistani intelligence fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. In those days, Osama bin Laden, who's the son of one of the largest building contractors in Saudi Arabia and friendly with the royal family, was not an outlaw. He was an emissary of the Saudi royal family. That's how he ended up in Afghanistan. And then after the Gulf War, he turned on Saudi Arabia and on the U.S. So the Saudis wanted the U.S. out. The U.S. needed new bases. the containment and sanctions regime against Iraq was beginning to crumble. The Europeans were not going along with this anymore. 400,000 children had been killed, according to the EU. The Clinton administration had admitted that this number was real. Madeleine Albright on television, when asked whether she thought it was worth killing 400,000 Iraqi children to contain Saddam Hussein, thought for about a nanosecond and then said, yes, I think it was worth it. So the whole project of containment was not working, and the presence of U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia was based on that project, so they had to go in directly and transform the whole situation. In other words, they had to invade and occupy Iraq, and they wanted to take the oil there. So in February 2001, 9 months before September 11th, in one of the first cabinet meetings, one of the first subjects that Donald Rumsfeld brings up is regime change in Iraq before any supposed imminent weapons of mass destruction threat. Then September 11th happens, and the U.S. responds by going in and knocking over the Taliban and lamely pursuing a manhunt against Osama bin Laden. From that point on, there was this vigorous attempt to link Osama bin Laden and what was going on in Afghanistan with Iraq. Never mind that there was no evidence for that, and there is still no evidence for any link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. One of the first things that Donald Rumsfeld said that day was, he told me, he said, go massive, sweep it all up, related and not. So they then convinced us, based on lies, that there was this imminent, well, maybe not all of us, but they convinced the American people, to the extent that most folks went along with it, that there was this imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction and invaded. So just to recap, the war was sold on lies, and it was about direct control of resources for the sake of private profits of U.S. corporations and for the sake of the indirect control of resources so as to control the politics and trade policies and diplomacy of the rest of the planet for the long term in the interest of containing China and the EU. This logic, which is an imperial logic marked by avarice and arrogance and open disregard for the well-being of other people on this planet, since that invasion has marked almost every single decision that the administration made. So what happens? Well, they go in, first of all, fast and light. This is part of the Revolution of Military Affairs, the RMA. This is this project that comes from Rumsfeld. The idea was that the U.S. was going to have to fight continual wars, multiple wars, to transform the Middle East, dominate the planet, and always be ready to solve any problem, face any threat with military action. Rumsfeld thought the way to do that was to use technology to just overwhelm opponents and threaten the entire planet. So there was this idea that every war should be like Afghanistan, where you essentially use local mercenaries, send in special forces with them, and then use high technology, which is in communication with these special forces, who say, you know, bomb here, bomb there, and take care of things that way. So they went in without enough troops. They went in not really caring about what the nature of Iraqi society was. They had only the faintest idea of the politics, of the role of religion, of the ethnicity of the place, of what the real politics of that country were. First thing they did was lock down the oil ministry and the interior ministry, which is basically where the resources were and where the means of repression were, where the files were. Everything else in Baghdad was left unguarded, and there was immediately massive looting. That was the first thing that horrified and terrified those Iraqis who were glad to see the U.S. invasion, because there were a lot of Iraqis who, despite sanctions and despite 12 years of violence and abuse from the U.S., were actually nonetheless glad to see a U.S. invasion. The country is majority Shia. The Shia political parties that had opposed Saddam Hussein were repressed ruthlessly, and in the process, many rank-and-file regular Shia were also horribly oppressed and discriminated against. And those people, many of them were really glad to see the U.S. come in. They were under some rather serious misconceptions about what was going to happen. And I went there that first summer, and people were saying, thank you for getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Now go home. And they were sort of waiting for that to happen. So that group of people was horrified that their museums and hospitals were allowed to be looted while the U.S. stood by and did nothing. The next thing they did was appoint L. Paul Bremer to be the viceroy, the ambassador, the point man on running the occupation. Now, L. Paul Bremer didn't have the experience necessary to manage a project as complicated as a multi-ethnic society that had been through three major wars and subject to over a decade of sanctions and had a highly technologically complicated infrastructure that had been run into the ground. Those three wars were the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted 8 years, the first Gulf War, then the sanctions, then the third war. But L. Paul Bremer was put in there because he was an ideologue who shared this hardcore right-wing vision with this core group around Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. And he went in and immediately fired the entire military and began a program of de-Ba'athification. Saddam's Iraq was a police state. It had an enormous military of like 450,000 people and many, many secret police. And the man who was originally charged with managing the occupation, Jay Garner, his plan was to try and maintain as much continuity between the previous regime and the occupation, which is the tradition in military occupations. You use the bureaucracy of your vanquished enemy. But they didn't like that idea, so they got rid of him. And Jay Garner had experience in Kurdistan managing the relief effort up there in 1991. He had some sense of the terrain. Paul Bremer did not, but he was politically loyal. He shared the vision. So he fires the military and then begins de-Ba'athification. This was a single-party state where if you wanted to get ahead, if you wanted to go to medical school and then get a good job, you joined the Ba'ath Party. So the entire professional class were Ba'athists. There were all sorts of factions within the Ba'ath Party. It came out of an Arab nationalist moment and vision of the 1940s. It went through various permutations, took on many ideas from the left, but also from the right. It was in many ways a classically fascist party that used the symbols and some of the policies of the left, but basically just to pursue a hierarchical authoritarian project. But along the way, developed the economy and that sort of stuff. But many people in the Ba'ath Party just did it just because that's how you got ahead and would have been glad to serve the U.S. They didn't care, and they were waiting for jobs. What did these things that Paul Bremer did create? Well, they created a massive population of disgruntled former elites, and they became the core of the resistance. There are others in the resistance, I should just say. I interviewed three different resistance cells in this book, and it seemed to me that people fought for a number of reasons. Revenge, out of loyalty to their country, because they had been paid, whatever. So a lot of people in the resistance fought because they had lost family members during the war. But they very often linked up with these pieces of the old regime, the old police forces, the old military officers. And one group of resistance fighters that I interviewed said, no, we're the Iraqi military. We're still fighting. We're just fighting differently. The next thing they did that was marked by this ideology of avarice and arrogance and total disregard for people's well-being was instead of setting about to reconstruct the economy properly, which would have put Iraqis back to work and gotten the lights back on and gotten clean water in the taps, what they did was they quickly had a series of secret or nearly secret no-bid contracts that were offered, tendered, and snapped up by administration-connected firms, namely Halliburton and Bechtel and a slew of others. Now, the importance of reconstruction is multiple here. The economy is in disarray, so the legitimacy of the occupation is based on whether or not the lights go back on and whether people get jobs. And the way to do that would have been to hire Iraqis and to use Iraqi expertise and to use Iraqi people to do this. But instead, they gave Halliburton and Bechtel these contracts. In the process, they didn't set up any auditing or oversight procedures whatsoever. So the first allotment of U.S. taxpayer money for this was about $3 billion, then $18 billion, and then there'd been another eight after that, I believe. So close to $30 billion of your money has been spent on this process, as well as between $8 and $12 billion, no one knows, of Iraqi money. And they don't know because there's been no record keeping, no accounting whatsoever. So what happens when you hand giant corporations essentially blank checks and you have no mechanism to make sure that they are using the money on what they claim to be using it? Well, surprise, surprise, they run off with it and nothing happens. And that's what myself and a lot of journalists of the more independent streak spent the summer of 2004 doing after it had been like a year of this supposed reconstruction. We would go to these projects. And it was hard to find out what these projects were, even. They wouldn't tell you. They would claim security, which to some extent was a legitimate concern. Eventually, we would get lists of what water treatment factories, what power plants, what schools were supposedly being rehabilitated by KBR, a subsidiary of Halliburton, or by Bechtel, and go to these places. And again, we would see that nothing had been done. We would talk to the Iraqis there, and the Iraqis would say stuff like, "When this is one water treatment plant that I went to, a sewage treatment plant. The engineer said that Bechtel showed up and they painted the buildings and then they went away, and we haven't seen them. And then we demanded that they come back. They came back, and they took out some of the old broken equipment, and they haven't been here since. And this project was a year behind, and the one other time that this Iraqi had spoken out to an Iraqi journalist in a local newspaper, he then got harassing calls from Bechtel. So they were paying enough attention to manage their image, but not to actually do the work. So the important thing to know about these firms, too, is their intimate connection to the Bush administration. Bechtel has a long relationship. It's the largest privately owned construction company in the world. It was headed by James Baker, who worked in the first Bush administration, has other Bush family connections. And the primary culprit in all this is Halliburton, which was run by Dick Cheney, the vice president, before he became vice president. His contribution to Halliburton was buying a firm called Dreiser. Dreiser had $7 billion in outstanding asbestos lawsuits that somehow Cheney didn't know about. So what he did to Halliburton was essentially bankrupt it. So Halliburton barely turns a profit as it is, even though it has huge contracts supplying the military in Iraq and Afghanistan and rebuilding Iraq and now rebuilding on the Gulf Coast. And even with those contracts, it's barely turning a profit. Because if it hadn't been rescued by the Bush administration, it would be in bankruptcy. So this further fuels the insurgency. And as the situation devolved, and it was clear that there wouldn't be any stability, the U.S. military was put under more and more pressure to do an impossible job, which was to suppress this guerrilla war. And they couldn't do that because, as everybody knows about guerrilla wars, the only way the imperial power can win is in the political realm, by undermining and isolating the guerrillas politically and getting the population, which supports the guerrillas, to abandon the guerrillas. And if that can't be done, if the people can't be pried away from the guerrillas, then it's pretty hard to beat the guerrillas. And that was possible in Iraq if they had done the reconstruction right, but they failed to do that. So more and more people turned to the resistance and started giving support to the resistance. The situation got more and more violent. More and more pressure was put on the military to do something about this. The military was not given the money or charged with the task of rebuilding power plants. So instead, what they had to do was invade Fallujah, knock down two-thirds of the building, and kill between 1,000 and 2,000 civilians in the process, which inflamed the entire population of central Iraq. Fallujah is, among other things, known as the city of mosques. It's seen as like the heart of Sunni Iraqi culture and is symbolically important to all Iraqis. So the more repression the U.S. military uses, the more resistance there is from the people, then the more repression the U.S. military has to use, and downward the spiral goes. That inflames opinion in the rest of the Muslim world, and there are foreign fighters who are going in there. The administration tries to blame this entire thing on foreign fighters and say that if these Al-Qaeda-inspired foreign fighters could just be gotten out of Iraq, then the whole thing would be over. That's not true. That's to simplify it and to misrecognize the situation. But there are foreign fighters who go to Iraq. My translator, Akil, who I write about in the book, actually went back to Iraq. He got out of Iraq in March 2004, went to London, and then went back in October 2004 to try and get his parents to leave. But his parents refused to leave. His mother said she would rather die in her own country than live as a refugee in England. So on his way in, he was going in without an Iraqi passport, but he had a Coalition Provisional Authority travel documents. So he was driving from Jordan across the border into Iraq, and the border police stopped him. And they said, "This is interesting. You have coalition papers." And they took him aside and interviewed him, took down his license plate number, gave him a cup of tea, and then sent him on his way. And about 3 hours later, in the empty desert, he was barreling down one of these highways, and suddenly there are two SUVs full of guys with AK-47s and RPGs, and they pull him over, and they immediately go right to him and like, "You're Akil, aren't you?" And he was like, "Yeah." And they're like, took him aside, blindfolded him, kidnapped him, accused him of being a British spy, and were threatening to kill him. And he was naming names. He was saying, "No, I was, I was a translator. I worked with journalists who were independent. I didn't work with the occupation." And he was naming the names of people he had known who had been connected to the resistance, and none of this worked. And then, interestingly, he named the name of a young sheikh from Ramadi that he and I had interviewed together. And they said, "You really know this guy?" And he described the guy's house and everything. And then the next day, that sheikh showed up and rescued my friend. And so he was taken to Ramadi, and he said, but in Ramadi, the town was under the control of the resistance. And among the resistance fighters he met were a group of 50 guys, from one or two from Afghanistan, many from Yemen, some from Egypt, some from Syria. And there were even Iranian Shia in this Sunni fundamentalist city who had come originally to help Muqtada Sadr, a radical Shia cleric, and then when he laid down his arms and made peace with the, maybe not made peace, but had a ceasefire with the U.S., some of these Shia foreign fighters from Iran had actually gone to Fallujah and were then in Ramadi. So there are foreign fighters there, thanks to the failure, the tactical failure of the Bush administration to do anything that would have curbed the violence. So this is the situation militarily. Politically, what's been going on? At first, Bremer said there couldn't be elections in the summer of 04. We forget this now because there have been elections, and this is how it went down. He said, no, there can't be elections. We're going to have to appoint a government, but we really want there to be elections. But we can't have elections because we don't have a proper census data, and it wouldn't be fair to have elections if we didn't have a really good census. And the Iraqis would say, well, you could use the food rolls. During the sanctions, Saddam set up a program of food distribution where every household, rich or poor, got a food basket. And the files of that program listed the ages and names and addresses of every Iraqi, and they could be used as the basis for voting rolls. So Iraqis again and again would ask, and journalists and press conferences would ask about this, and it was denied by the U.S. government. Finally, the supreme leader of the Iraqi Shia, Ayatollah al-Sistani, called demonstrations. And he's a guy who never leaves his house. He's sort of monkish, highly revered, even by some Sunnis. Tries to stay above the fray in much of Iraqi politics. And he finally called directly for protests to demand elections. And in no time, I was there for this, there were hundreds of thousands of Shia on the streets, threatening to escalate, blocking traffic. And it became clear that the occupation had to acquiesce and create elections. So that's why there were elections in Iraq. So then they negotiated, and they had elections almost a year later, and against the wishes of the Bush administration, they were forced to have these elections. And what happened? Well, they got a government that's dominated by two main Shia parties, both of which are extremely loyal to Iran, because when they were being persecuted and jailed and tortured by Saddam, Iran was the country that would give them aid and support, and where they lived for, in some cases, two decades. So the political situation now is that there's a government that does, in fact, have some legitimacy. It was, in fact, elected by Iraqis, but it is not to the liking of the Bush administration because it is dominated by these pro-Iranian religious fundamentalists. Not that the Bush administration cares much about the religiosity of these forces, but they're doing things economically that the Bush administration doesn't like. They immediately started negotiating with Iran to build a pipeline through Iran that would allow Iran to get some of the oil from southern Iraq and get some of the revenue, and they would export through Iran. And the minority faction in the government is the Kurds, and they're totally dependent on the U.S. and adherent to the U.S. line. The Sunnis sat out the elections, and so they have very few seats. This government negotiated a constitution. This has been in the news. The process by which they negotiated that constitution was in violation of the law set down for that negotiation. It was supposed to be, there would be a final draft of the constitution that would be distributed to the entire country. Everybody could read it. Well, the fact of the matter was they were making backroom amendments to that constitution up to the last minute, so the people of Iraq did not get to read, in most cases, the constitution and did not know what they were voting on. But nonetheless, it exists, that constitution, and there will be new elections in which the Sunni will probably participate. So you have this political process. It's unclear where that's going. You have an insurgency against the U.S., which seems to be only heating up. You have a massive crime wave, which was initiated in many ways by Saddam Hussein in October 2002, I digress here for a second, when in preparation for the war, he emptied Abu Ghraib. You might remember those scenes. And I think when history is written, we'll see that as the beginning of the insurgency of Iraq. That's when the whole project of asymmetrical warfare in Iraq begins. He unleashes the criminal class, many of whom were his political enemies, but many of whom have become very useful to the resistance. And if any of you have read Frantz Fanon, you might think about what Frantz Fanon said about the lumpen proletariat, the class that is so excluded and abused by the system that Marx thought couldn't be revolutionary because they had no stake in things, unlike workers, unlike the proletariat. But Fanon said, no, because of their abuse and their exclusion, they have this courage. They're the ones that will be revolutionary. They're the ones that will be ready to do violence. And that's very true in Iraq. The Iraqi resistance involves the criminal class, is very criminal in nature, uses that criminal element, breeds it. So you have this crime wave. You have an economy that's kept alive only by the fact that oil is so expensive. But oil production is in decline. All other production is in decline. People still live on this food basket. If that were removed, there'd be total chaos. You have a region that's absolutely primed for instability. You have links between the Kurds and the Israelis. They go back to the early 60s, where the Israelis saw the Kurds as a sort of fifth column within the Arab world, because the Kurds are not Arab, allies that they could cultivate to undermine states like Iraq and Syria that threatened them. So Arabs hate that. They hate Israel, many Iraqi Arabs. They hate the fact that the Kurds have been trying to secede for many years and that Israel helps them. The Turks hate the fact that the Kurds have power because there's a large Kurdish population in Turkey. Turkey has threatened to invade northern Iraq. It did invade northern Iraq in the past. You have U.S. cross-border action into Syria already, where the U.S. military has been fighting Syrian troops and killing them. You have these deep and close links between Iran and the two main Shia parties, the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. There's an alleged arms trade there. You have Saudi Arabia gripped by a low-level civil war that is increasingly linked up with the war that's going on in Anbar, the western deserts of Iraq, where there's geographic and cultural connections with Saudi Arabia. And you have, worst of all, a low-level civil war between Shia and Sunni in Iraq. It's not a civil war of sort of one community against another community, but rather the politicized elements in each community attacking the other's politicians or randomly killing civilians. While the majority of Sunni and the majority of Shia say, we're all Iraqi, there's never been a civil war between Sunni and Shia, we don't want a civil war. But that, unfortunately, is not how civil wars happen. They rarely happen when the majority of people are like, hey, let's go destroy that other community. It's when a small vanguard in one community starts attacking and provoking the other, and then that escalates. And that's what you have now. If you follow the news closely, you see every day there are these assassinations, you know, two or three bodies of dead Shia or four or five bodies of dead Sunni. Sometimes it's 30 or 40 bodies showing up. So this is a situation that the Bush administration has left us with. Now, what are the political possibilities and the responses from the U.S.? Well, George Bush has said, not on my watch, so that means 3 years of this. The U.S. will stay there for 3 years more. What if a Democrat gets elected? So let's say there's a Watergate-style collapse of this administration. Louis Libby, who is Dick Cheney's chief of staff, has been indicted, as you all know. Let's say Karl Rove gets indicted. Let's say they give up Dick Cheney and it's linked to the president. And there's a complete collapse. People in the press and in the political class start talking about the price tag on Iraq and questioning where the hell it's all headed. Well, it might be time for an elite consensus to bring in a Democrat, and they might bring in Hillary Clinton or someone like that, and she could do what her husband did, which was raise taxes a little bit on the richest percentage of the American population and then clean up the debt. That's what he did. You know, he raised taxes just a little bit. It wasn't that aggressive. But it was gave the state enough income to pay down the debts he had inherited from Republicans. He also, you know, then pursued domestic austerity to legitimize his tax cuts. He also had to end welfare as we know it, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine Hillary Clinton doing that to get the books in order. But could you imagine Hillary Clinton, a woman in charge of this party that lives in absolute fear that they're going to be called chicken? Can you imagine her being like, I'm going to be the president that loses Iraq and the Middle East and destroys whatever little macho image the Democrats might have been trying to create? I can't see that. I cannot see a Democrat losing the war. So what does that mean? That means like another 7 years of this? Very possibly. And then maybe some right-wing populist Republican could come in. But basically, what I'm saying is I don't see how the U.S. political class is going to let go of Iraq, because they have no desire to. They want that oil, and it would be such an enormous defeat for them. But on the other hand, I don't think they can maintain this forever. The situation is too out of control. Just to make that clear, what does that mean? It's like if you're a journalist and you go to Iraq, you cannot leave Baghdad. You cannot walk the streets. You dress like an Iraqi. You keep your mouth shut all the time. Everything is point A to point B. Any Westerner who is caught anywhere on the roads in Iraq would immediately be turned over to the resistance, either turned over by a patriot or sold for money. That's how out of control Iraq is from a journalist's perspective. So what should happen? given this bleak picture? Like, what could be a remedy? Well, what should happen is a regional conference in which all of the parties that now have a dog in the fight, Turkey, all these countries that I described their engagements, Israel, Syria, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, all of these countries have their intelligence forces involved, are giving aid to one party or another. All of these countries should be brought to the table to discuss how to de-escalate and extract themselves from this situation, and a regional conference that also puts at the core, which is now linked to Iraq, the question of a Palestinian state and the rights of Palestinians. Because that, for Arabs, is the other great crime, as they see it, against the Arab nation. So that would inevitably have to be discussed in relation to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The other thing in Iraq is that the Sunnis, the Sunni elite, who are not nice people, the former Saddam folks, need to be brought into the government. They need to be given some power back if there's to be a cessation of this guerrilla war. And there has to be massive reparations paid by the United States because we destroyed this country. And even though we've already paid massively, that money went to Halliburton and Bechtel. But there would have to be startup money given to some sort of new Iraq so that they could rebuild and get on their feet. And that would have to be really invested in reconstruction and used by Iraqis. Now, I have no faith that any of that is going to happen anytime soon, but I just wanted to put it out there, since one does sort of have to be responsible to the political imagination, one does have to sort of lay out a different set of possibilities. So on that note, I'll sit down, I guess.
What we'll do is we'll open up to questions on the panel. But first, I'll start off with a question. One of my students, his daughter was serving in Iraq during the last election. And she said, in her words, she really didn't believe in what she was doing there. She didn't agree with their mission, but it was her job, so that she did it. And she was looking to the American people at the election time for something to happen. And when they voted for Bush again, she felt very dismayed by that and let down by the American people. In your time over there, did you get that message from any of the folks in the service?
Yeah. Most of the soldiers I met, see if this was representative, were Republican. The military is very Republican. And it seemed to me that particularly when you're at war and at risk, it makes that job easier if you can believe in your leadership. I only embedded with two different units, a Florida National Guard unit and the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah. And there were sort of dissident liberal Democrats in each squad I was with, but most soldiers didn't get access to the news, didn't really know about the extent of the lies, and were busy with their immediate tasks.
We'll start down at the end with Sandy if he has any questions.
What did you think when you spoke to the soldiers about the massive graves or the fighting that occurred when the soldiers lost somebody in their squad or unit? Did they still feel that it was worth being there?
Yeah. Most soldiers, like I said, that I met, and I didn't meet that many. I mean, and I'd like, you know, you guys should say how your units felt about it, but I mean, I didn't embed more recently. I didn't, when I was in Kurdistan just recently, I didn't embed. Most soldiers that I met tried to believe in the war, did believe in the war, had every form of authority around them from television to their officers, was encouraging them to believe in the war. So it took tremendous sort of intellectual independence and creative thought under those circumstances to buck the trend and be like, I have to do this job, I have to risk my life, I have to cooperate in helping save my friends at the same time that I think this whole thing is a lie. That takes a tremendously supple mind to do that. And I did meet soldiers like that, but most soldiers were just sort of like, I remember one guy in Fallujah saying he was hanging out with a friend of his who wanted to be a paramedic in Chicago, and that's why he had joined the military, and he had done his 8 years, and he had been trained as a medic and been in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, and there was this tremendous push on in that unit of the 82nd at that time in Fallujah to get people to re-enlist. And this guy was getting tremendous pressure for this and resisting and complaining, and he eventually got out and became a paramedic. But his friend, when questioned, said, you know, I've only done 2 years on an 8-year contract, so I kind of have to believe in the war. He actually said it. Whereas his friend was like, this is a lie. There were no weapons of mass destruction. This is about oil, and I don't want to do it anymore. So, I mean, we all do that. I guess we all have to deceive ourselves about things. And I think that if someone is faced with the really difficult task of being a soldier in that war, in most cases it's easier not to think about how wrong the war is, but to think about the immediate tasks and, if necessary, put your faith in the leaders.
Okay, Marissa?
How do you think it would be different if the elections for President Bush had been flipped and Kerry had won?
I mean, I don't think that a Democrat would have invaded Iraq. I think that if a Democrat had inherited the war this time around, they would continue along with it, that Kerry would have gone along with this. But not because he's John Kerry so much, but because I think that's what a Democrat would do, given that a war was underway. I don't think Gore would have done this necessarily because Gore is so much better than Bush, but it was objectively such an insane thing to do. Forget my politics of being opposed to war and not thinking that U.S. corporations deserve the support of the U.S. state or deserve to control Iraqi oil, any of that. Imagine that you support the agenda of giving as much power to U.S. corporations as possible under whatever conditions. Still, the invasion of Iraq and the occupation of Iraq was insane. And anyone who knew anything about the region told the Bush administration exactly what was going to happen. In fact, there's a really interesting footnote to this whole story. In preparation for the war, they played these war games in which they were invading some fake country, and these war games took place in space, you know, in real places with real soldiers, and also in cyberspace. And the guy that they hired to be the enemy commander, the dictator general, whatever it was an American general named Von Riper. And he, much to the displeasure of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, first thing he did was he shut down the communications in his fake country, and there was no radio traffic. His soldiers communicated with motorcycle messengers and through the loudspeakers of mosques, and he used suicide bombers in speedboats to attack U.S. ships. And twice they stopped the war games. And they were like, sorry, you can't do that. That's not how it's going to go. It's going to be a conventional war, and we're going to kick your ass. And he was like, well, that's actually not how Iraq's going to be, so this is what I'm doing. And he quit in disgust. This was a minor item in the European press. I don't think it got any attention in the U.S. press. So everybody knew what was going to happen, and they didn't want to hear about it. And that's actually an interesting question. Why was it that they did that? Because Dick Cheney, when he was defense secretary for Daddy Bush in 1991, said the following. Once you've got Baghdad, it's not clear what you do with it. It's not clear what kind of government you would put in place of the one that's currently there. How much credibility is that government going to have if it's set up by the United States military when it's there? I think to have American military forces engaged in a civil war inside Iraq would fit the definition of a quagmire. And we have absolutely no desire to get bogged down in that fashion. That was Dick Cheney in 1991. So how could that guy do this? I think what happened is that the leadership of this elements in the Republican Party got so emboldened by a sort of a 20-year slew of victories that began with Grenada. You know, the U.S. military is defeated in Vietnam, and then Reagan invades Grenada, this tiny island in the Caribbean, and this is the beginning of the comeback of the U.S. And then there's the invasion of Panama, then there was Gulf War I, and then there was Afghanistan, and there was Kosovo along the way. And in every one of these interventions, these direct interventions, there were all sorts of other indirect interventions. In every one of these direct interventions, people warned and said, this is dangerous, this is going to lead to a quagmire, don't do it. And each time they turned out to be right. And particularly in Afghanistan, I think with that victory in Afghanistan, they finally took leave of their senses and they decided that intelligence, research, all that didn't matter. That kind of hubris marks some of the most egregious and serious military and political blunders in world history. Think about the Civil War. Why did the Civil War happen? Because the South attacked the North. The South attacked the North because they knew the North wouldn't fight back. And they knew the North wouldn't fight back because the Southern elites had become so intoxicated on their own ideology that they really believed that their slaveocracy was a superior society to the North. And they thought that the North, despite its huge industrial base, would fold. And they knew that most officers were Southern and that they would have the whole army. They were horribly wrong. When they began that war, they didn't think, well, on the other hand, there could be a four-year war that ends with the military occupation of the South and the destruction of our whole economy here. Likewise, World War I, both the French and the Germans knew that they were going to win, and both sides went to the front with 2 weeks' supplies, but instead it turned into a four-year bloodletting. So we have one of those situations where elites got so confident that they did what in retrospect was totally irrational, even in terms of their interests.
David?
My question is, in both the units that you were embedded with, one was active duty and the other was reserve, did you see an influx of problems between, and like you would have more incidents or more casualties with the active duty versus the reserve? How did you see that?
Well, it's not really fair to compare them because one unit was in Baghdad in 2003, August 2003, before things had gotten really bad. And they both had about the same rate of casualties. But the situations were very different. The National Guardsmen, the Florida National Guardsmen, were trying to do peace enforcement. They did some offensive missions, but they were mostly just trying to maintain order in this neighborhood. And the 82nd Airborne were outside of Fallujah. They weren't right in it. And they were mostly doing offensive missions, trying to like hit high-value targets, as they called it. But I think the statistics show that it's safer to be on the offensive for American soldiers, that like reserve units, that particularly logistical units that have to drive the supplies, are getting very badly hit. And the units that get to choose the time and place of their fight are better off.
Before we go to the next person, is there any perception that the National Guard or Reserves were poorly trained to be in the situation they were? And because of that poor training, it may have led to higher casualties? And was there any dissension in the ranks, you know, like as far as the officers in the Reserves and their capabilities?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, again, this is not scientific. It's just two units. So it seemed to me that there's an array of training in the Reserves. You know, you have people who've been in elite units next to people who have very little training and no combat experience. But one thing that seemed to be pretty clear from all the reservists or the National Guard that I talked to were that the quality of the officers in the National Guard was definitely less than in the regular army. And one of the problems that these National Guardsmen expressed about their officers was that the officers came from civilian life and were doing this one-year tour and saw it as this great opportunity, not a lifelong career where they were, in a way, much more locked into a military culture and much more responsible to their men and to the hierarchy and better trained and all that sort of stuff as in the regular army. They were there to sort of earn their chops in a year and then go back and be the chief of police in, like, Tuxahula, wherever. And in some cases, they were very eager to get casualties, you know. That would look good for them. They could go back to civilian life and be like, yeah, you know, it was really serious. We lost one guy and got, like, three Purple Hearts. And so Camilo Mejia, who is one of the characters in this book, who is with a different unit of the Florida National Guard than the one that I embedded in, he was in Ramadi. His officers actually provoked, as I described in the end of the book, provoked a small sort of mutiny, you could say, by sending this unit, this platoon, out to the same place to block traffic for 3 or 4 days in a row, in violation of all written procedures, I understand it, for how infantry should operate in these situations. They went back at the same time, in the same place, and all the soldiers were convinced that the officers, their unit had arrived late, and it didn't have its combat infantry badge, which is one of the sort of more understated military badges, and it means that your unit has met and engaged the enemy. And so they weren't in there for the invasion. So these guys didn't have their CIBs. And the soldiers on the street were fine with that. But the officers wanted to earn their CIB, and so they were using this platoon as bait. And it got to the point where Camilo refused to go back out, and four other staff sergeants in this platoon that were being sent out again and again also met with the captain. They said, look, you know, this is not going to work. We're not going to go back out today at the same time to the same place and do the same thing, stopping traffic, and wait to get attacked. And so the officer was forced to change the plans. So they went out a bit earlier, and they found, in fact, a massive IED waiting for them, and they would have taken enormous amounts of casualties. So that's one example of officers of the reserve passing through for 1 year, being definitely eager and willing to take casualties, to have their men take casualties, in the interest of boosting their career, coming home as war heroes, having more opportunities in business and politics at home. That was the main difference I saw in terms of the quality of those two sides of the Army.
Brooke?